This is Robert Rogers from Parkinson's Recovery, and what you've just joined is the first in a series of teleseminars I'll do each week that look at various aspects of what it means to be able to feel better. Next week, I'm going to talk about the first of four steps that are required to be able to recover. The 2 weeks from today, I'll be talking about the second step, and then three, I'll be talking about the third. And once you've got all steps in order, by Jove, you are clearly committed to the road to recovery from the symptoms of Parkinson's disease. What I'm going to do today is to talk about the decisions that need to be made day in and day out about what treatments might be best for you to consider that will give you some relief from your symptoms. There are literally, and this is no exaggeration, hundreds of treatment modalities that are hanging out there. And as some people have so eloquently expressed in correspondence with me, some of these really are being proposed by people who are really smoke screens. They are, as we used to call them, charlatans. They really don't have any substance to them. But many of them actually do have significant substance, and they are giving individuals relief from their symptoms. And so the difficult challenge is to be able to hear one report after another from one person after another who says, well, I tried treatment X, and guess what? This was a great relief to me. Another person says, well, I tried a very different thing, and this was a great relief to me. And then as you begin to listen, and you'll see on the member website, you'll see a lot of people reporting doing one thing after another that helped them for one reason or another. If you begin to list all of those recommendations, you are not going to have the time to pursue everything that you hear is supposed to help you. I mean, it's just not going to happen. And, of course, there's also the practical limitation of resources and funds. There are, I know, people, and maybe some people who are listening to this particular discussion who have limitless funds, and that's not an issue. But even if that's not an issue for you, time is an issue, and your body cannot tolerate having exposure to too many treatments or too many interventions at one time. The body really takes time to be able to respond to any particular single intervention. So the fact is that choices have to be made, and so the perplexing challenge is, well, what in the world then are you going to do to figure out what's going to be the best choices for you? That's the topic. But first, what I want to do is to give you an overview of what it means when you tell somebody else, a friend, a family member, or even a stranger standing in the line at the grocery store, I have Parkinson's disease. Now, that has a, as I think everyone can resonate with, a very clear and distinct connotation. There is a belief template that is floating around the universe, which basically says, oh, once you're formally diagnosed with this disease, which is called Parkinson's, the good news is you're not going to die anytime soon, but the bad news is you're going to always get worse. And the words are kind of interesting. The words that are used are, it is, quote, progressive, and it is, quote, degenerative. Now, I first want to point out the word progressive can either be a direction upward or a direction downward. But when the word is used, there's always the assumption that progressive means, oh, gee, too bad, you're going to always get worse. There's just no way out of it. Now, what I know many of you already realize is that's certainly not the belief I have. And one of the missions and one of the goals of Parkinson's recovery is to document from interview after interview with one person after another that, in fact, people are recovering from the symptoms of Parkinson's disease, that we do have individuals that have actually fully recovered and are symptom-free today. So the fact is, it is simply not true. What is true is, if you look at the research literature, whenever they do studies, they will track the, again, I'm going to put this in quotes, the progression of Parkinson's. And what you find is, in study after study, an average of 10% of the people who are tracked who happen to be on medication do not get worse. I repeat, they do not get worse. They basically stay the same. So the research evidence, just on its face, clearly indicates it's not true that everybody is going to get worse. Now, there's a second little fact that I also want to convey to you that turns out to be rather fascinating. Also in the literature, you find another compelling and consistent finding. Between 25% and 33%, depending on the study that you look like, of the individuals who have the diagnosis of Parkinson's are determined to have been misdiagnosed. In other words, the diagnosis is wrong. Now, how do you figure that out? Well, they figure that out from autopsies. When people die, they look at the existence of what is called Lewy bodies in the inner brain, and what they discover is, gee, in people who have the diagnosis, oftentimes there's no evidence of any depletion of the cells that actually manufacture dopamine. So, if you'll think about it, this means that if you're sitting in a support group, if you look to the person to your left and if you look to the person to your right, chances are one of the three of you has a diagnosis of Parkinson's, but guess what? You actually do not have Parkinson's. Here's what I think. I think there's a choice that I know many, many people have to make about what you tell your friends and your family about whether or not you have, quote, Parkinson's disease. It's a true struggle. I'm getting correspondence with people every week that has different flavors, but it basically says, I've been struggling with this condition now for 8 years, for 10 years, for 5 years, for 6 years, and I'm getting to the point where I'm a little concerned that people at work are going to begin to wonder what's going on, because my tremor is getting a bit more pronounced, or my movements are getting a bit more awkward, et cetera, et cetera. And so I don't really want anybody to know that I have, quote, Parkinson's disease. Here's what I think. I don't think you ought to say to anyone that you have, quote, Parkinson's disease. I think it's a mistake. When you do that, what happens? So let's say you see a person who's been not a dear or a close friend, but they've been a friend for 10 years. You see them and you're thinking, you know, I know them pretty well. Maybe I ought to let them know that, you know, a couple of years ago I was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. So you say, okay, you know, honesty is a good thing. I'm just going to tell them. So what you say to your friend is, you know, Cheryl, what I wanted you to know is that you probably noticed that I'm not moving quite as quickly, and I'm having a little bit of trouble eating or swallowing my food. I just wanted you to know that I was diagnosed a couple of years with Parkinson's disease. Okay, what does Cheryl do? Cheryl probably has heard of Parkinson's disease, so what she's going to say, obviously, to her friend is, oh, no, God, I'm really sorry to hear that. And then what Cheryl is thinking is, oh, yeah, God, that's the one that you always get worse. There's nothing they can do about it. Oh, God. And then what does Cheryl think? What Cheryl thinks is, whew, whew, I'm sure glad I don't have that disease. Okay, now what kind of a reaction is that from a friend? Well, it's a natural reaction. Carol, your friend, obviously likes you, but the fact is that she's giving a very normal and very realistic reaction. It is the case that oftentimes what friends might do is begin to distance themselves from you. After all, you're not going to be as well next year as you are this year. So there's a little distancing. There's a little feeling of being uncomfortable because she's feeling like, well, I feel a little guilty because I don't have it and you do. And boy, am I sure glad that's the case. So you see, everybody is into the negative belief system that you're inevitably going to get worse. You're trapped. And then, of course, what we know from the extensive discussion in the medical literature, there are no medicines that really can reverse this. There's nothing out there that's actually been identified in a formal medical research sense. There's no drug, there's no treatment that actually is available that can reverse this particular condition. So you are in a totally negative framework. You have labeled yourself to be something called Parkinson's, not the person who you are, but something that is called Parkinson's that has a certain set of very distinct characteristics. Now, here's another little fact that I want to make sure everybody holds. I've been listing all of the symptoms that people tell me they have of Parkinson's, and I initially started with about 70 symptoms that when I started years ago, that I found in the literature. That list now is into the hundreds. I mean, we're talking about a very, very, very long list of symptoms that are associated with diagnoses of Parkinson's. I'm almost stepping back and thinking, boy, if you put all this together, it's about every disease imaginable. I mean, every disease that doesn't have a distinct diagnosis. It is really the garbage can of symptoms that represents something that we really don't know very much about. And you know from this discussion, from listening, that this is true. You very well know that if you have conversations with other individuals with Parkinson's, that their symptoms are very, very likely to differ, and sometimes significantly, from your symptoms. So the symptom sets are significantly different. So here's what I think. I think that the positive, the healthy approach to make is not to accept a label that anyone has placed on this particular condition, but simply to identify symptoms. To basically say, today I've got a little shaking in my left arm and my right leg seems to be particularly stiff. Now, that's acknowledging the signals that your body happens to be giving to you today, and those signals likely are going to change from day to day and even from moment to moment. Now, I want to say that there's clearly nothing wrong with getting a medical diagnosis of Parkinson's. That's what medical doctors do. They cannot prescribe any medication unless they have a diagnosis. It would not be ethical. And they've got to protect themselves legally, so they just can't go out and be prescribing Sinemet or any of the other Parkinson's medications without doing a thorough diagnostic assessment. So that is a model that exists, and it's a model that works for people. But the fact is that if we allow ourselves to be sucked into that model, you're into a negative framework. You're into the belief that you're always going to get worse and there has to be somebody else out there, some other intervention that can fix you. If you switch that approach and begin to simply check in with your body and identify the reality that there are certain clear symptoms that your body is giving you, certain signals about what's going on, it's a very different experience. So let's say that we do this again, and you see your friend of 10 years that you've had for 10 years, and you decide, no, I'm not going to tell them I have Parkinson's disease. I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to tell them how I'm feeling today. So what you say is, hi, Cheryl. How are you? Cheryl says, I'm okay. How about you? And what you say is, well, yeah, strangest thing. I woke up today and I was having a little shaking in my left hand. And Cheryl says, oh, really? You know, that happened to me last week. I couldn't believe it. And I hear my hand was shaking. You know what? Everybody shakes. Everybody has tremors. Some of them are more pronounced than others, but everybody has tremors. So all of a sudden, she's able to identify with something that's happened to her. Or you say, yeah, I had some, boy, my right leg was really stiff. I'm really having trouble walking today. And again, she says, yeah, that's happened to my husband, or that happened to my brother, and boy, and here's what they did about it. Sometimes, you know, you can get into stories about what people have done, so you get into that kind of approach or framework. So I think it's very positive. Then she's sharing with you something that she can identify with. She has those symptoms too, and then you're bonding and you're looking for constructive solutions. The other reality is when you identify for yourself specific symptoms that you may be associated with, you're not into the label of Parkinson's, so you are not into that solution set. You are into a wide universal solution set that identifies there may be many, many different possibilities available that will provide some significant relief for your symptoms. That's a very different way of thinking because for most of us, we have a number of systemic challenges that are present in our bodies. That have nothing to do formally or specifically with the diagnosis of Parkinson's. And so when you step yourself up and out of that particular narrow framework, then you are into a much more creative possible set of solutions for whatever might be the problems that that confront you. And of course, the other difficulty, as I'm sure everyone is aware of, and as we've done some teleseminars with, if you have a diagnosis of more than one condition, so it's not just Parkinson's, but perhaps it's high blood pressure, or perhaps it's a cholesterol problem, and medical professionals are providing some assistance to that, then you are into various subspecialties of treatment, which means you're taking a number of different medications that may then have the potential to interact with one another in ways that nobody could have imagined. And why is that? Because your body is unique. It's individualistic to you and who you are as a person. So I think that the healthy approach that makes us psychologically strong and able to figure out what we need to do for ourselves is to simply put aside a formal diagnosis of Parkinson's, leave that up to the doctors to deal with however they choose to do so, and to, in our own dealings, is to identify symptoms and to simply listen to what our bodies are actually telling us. So that's my first recommendation. It's after a lot of thought, I think it's a bad idea to tell people that you have any disease and that it's a good idea to simply begin talking about symptoms that may be up for you. Now, what we're really then faced with is, okay, so certain symptoms are up for you today, whatever they might be. And of course, you also know very well that those symptoms shift. What may be up today can be very different from last week or can be very different from next week. And of course, also what's true is the road to recovery is full of spikes, so that you can feel really wonderful for a day or a week or a month, and then all of a sudden that can spike downward, so you have a bad day or a bad week. It's a very natural kind of a process, as it has been reported to me by many, many, many individuals. Now, I have a framework that, as many of you know, I have promoted about the causes, the fundamental causes of the symptoms of Parkinson's. And many of you probably have noticed that when I write about Parkinson's, I typically will say the symptoms of Parkinson's. And for those of you who are editors out there, you may have thought, boy, this guy really needs some good editing assistance. Why doesn't he just say Parkinson's? And you now know the reason for that. The reason for that is I think it's a mistake to identify everything with the tagline Parkinson's. I think it's healthy to be able to think in terms of symptoms. So now, what are the underlying causes that can create the symptoms? Well, there are three general categories of causes that we know from the literature are factors that create the symptoms, and also from extensive discussions and interviews with people who have the symptoms. So those categories that I want to offer to you are, first, the general category of toxins. It's really absolutely unequivocal from the literature that toxins of various natures can create the symptoms of Parkinson's. Now, there are some really wonderful researchers out there that are looking at the specifics of this and identifying if perhaps one specific type of toxin is more the culprit than others. My personal spin on that approach is, I'm glad people are doing it, but I don't think that's where the money is at. I think that the reality is the body gets overloaded with too many toxic external substances. I don't care what names you give to them, mercury, lead, pesticides, you name it. The body all of a sudden gets to a point where it can't rid itself naturally of these toxins, and so there begins to be a buildup at the cellular level. Sometimes these toxins can be so egregious in the body that they actually accumulate on the surface of the cells. And how in the world can cells function when they're being mucked up by toxins? So I personally think that it really can be a combination of different toxins that can create the problem. And the key is, if that's what's up for you, then to be able to delve more deeply into the question for you personally, okay, I think toxins are at the top of my list. Now, let me think. I wonder which ones I ought to be most attentive to, because you see there are different cleansing approaches that can be used for different toxic problems. And of course, for each of us, we all have toxins. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that you may have toxins, but I don't. That's not true. We all have toxins. The question is the accumulation of toxins in the body to a certain point that it's mucking up neural networks and creating neurological confounds in the body. So toxins are the first general issue. And with that, I want to also identify allergic reactions. There's also the category of pathogens. We can have creepy crawlers in our bodies that also muck up that neural network system. Now that sounds pretty horrible, but the fact is that there are fungi that are very easy to ingest in yeast, which is in every bread product. And the fungus is a live organism. These are actually live critters who begin crawling around the tissues of our bodies. And the fungi, we all have fungi, but it can be that they can get so extensive that they also can muck up the entire ability of the body, the immune system, and all of the other systems in the body that then, in effect, wind up influencing the neurological system. So it may be that we've got creepy crawlers in our body, either at the cellular level or in our digestive system. They're called pathogens. There are naturopaths out there. There are acupuncturists who specialize in ridding the body of pathogens. You basically scare those little critters out of your body because they no longer want to hang around. So this is the first general category. We all have, to a certain extent, toxins and pathogens and bacterial infections. Many people believe that when you have a bacterial infection and you take antibiotics and you feel better, it's done. You know, all of those little critters are killed. And that's the way it's discussed sometimes. Well, you've got to take enough of the antibiotics to kill all of the bad little bacterial critters. Well, guess what? That doesn't happen. Those little critters, really, there's always a residue of those little bacterial critters that have nested themselves somewhere at the cellular level in the body. So if you've had infections, you also have a residue of bacterial infections somewhere, and they may be lodged in neural pathways as well. So that's the first general category. It's the big picture, and it may be what is most foremost for you in terms of aggregating your symptoms. The second general category that I want to offer to you is the general category of trauma and stress. And again, we know that the energetic component that creates the symptoms of Parkinson's is very much connected to the issue of trauma. Now, when I say trauma, this is a pretty wide encompassing category. Trauma can actually evolve at a very young age. It can actually evolve in embryo when we are children. If we are in the womb of our mother and our mothers and fathers are struggling with horrendous stress or with horrendous challenges in their lives, I can assure you that you have been traumatized. If, for example, you are an embryo at a time of wartime, there is no more traumatic experience for a child who's being formulated in the womb, but to have experienced the feelings of their mother and their father during times of stress, of the stress of war. So that in itself can be traumatic. Second traumatic experience, of course, is birth itself. And we always, when we work with clients, we always have questions about, well, tell us about your birth. And it's surprising to me, about 50% of the people will come back and say, I don't have any information about my birth. My mother never told me what happened. That's sometimes one of the most significant and profound impacts that we can have in our lives, the whole experience of birth. It's traumatic for a child to be born, especially if there are forceps, especially if there's an emergency, especially if there are problems over the birth, especially if the mother is herself traumatized. So that, at that very, very early age, can be a trauma that you may not even remember anything about, but may actually have a profound impact on what you carry now as a mature adult. So trauma can occur at a very early age. It can obviously occur in childhood with traumatic experiences that may range from abuse from one relative or a friend or another to the loss of a parent or another relative who was deeply loved unexpectedly, or in some cases really a loss of a sibling, a sister or a brother at a very early age. And so these early untimely deaths can also be traumatic. So as you move forward in your life, I think you can probably identify a number of traumas that you have experienced that have emotional characteristics as well as physical characteristics that fall into that category of trauma. We all have trauma in our lives, but the fact is that sometimes it accumulates over a lifetime and gets to the point where we are leading a life of continuous stress. So I've discussed trauma in the context of being very, very old, so to speak, but it can be also very recent. It can be relationships that you've been in that have been stressful and that you may still be in, relationships with spouses or partners or friends that really are not working out well. It can be work situations that have been unusually challenging and stressful. That's trauma of its own right that might come into the category of continuous stress. Trauma can be pretty one-time kind of events, or it can be sustained in the form of continuous stress. So we are all exposed to challenges in life and stresses in life, and the reason why trauma and stress is also one of the big three reasons, one of the big three factors that create the symptoms of Parkinson's is it slips you into a place of being continuously alert and in fear that something is about to happen. And if you are in that place, then that means that the hormones in your body that create that ability to be on alert are always being pumped out. They are always being manufactured. So if you're always pumping out adrenaline, then what's the opportunity for your body to actually then generate dopamine, those serotonin melatonin kind of hormones that are the ones that allow us to relax and to lay back and to enjoy the pleasures and the joys of living. Well, there's not, because we're always into that continual state of being alert. There's a certain intensity to that energy that on the one hand is golden. It allows us to be able to accomplish miracles and incredible feats in our lives. But on the other hand, it's not such a great thing when it's turned on all the time. It's a bit like being around a friend that you may dearly love, but this friend likes to talk. And every time that you're with them, all they really want to do is talk at you rather than have a conversation with you. And if you'll notice, what happens to you when you're around a friend who always wants to talk at you, well, I can't speak for you, but I can speak for myself, I get tired. And what I want to do is separate from that friend because the energy behind it just poops me out. Well, that's what happens to the body. The body literally gets worn down because we're continuously on this place of alert. And so the key with that general category of trauma is to somehow tame it down a step or two so that we're able to balance out that energy. Let me be very clear. There's nothing at all wrong or bad about that energy I'm just describing. It's the energy of being alert, the energy of being disciplined, the energy of being focused, the energy of being able to accomplish something. It's no mystery that people who have the diagnosis of Parkinson's in their careers have been successes. They're the movers and shakers of the world. But the reality is that if that energy is turned on continuously, the body just literally gets pooped out and begins to send back to us signals that something is out of balance. And so, of course, what happens is there's a mismatch between the hormones that are connected to that alert status and the hormones that are connected to that more relaxed status. Now, notice I don't want you to hang on to the single hormone of dopamine, which is typically the one that's tagged as being the, quote, problem of Parkinson's. That's not really it. We have over 40 hormones in our body that are circulating about it in any moment in time. And so it's a question of adjusting the relative balance of all of those over 40 hormones from moment to moment. So the challenge with dopamine, of course, is that if we're always on alert, the body's not asked to produce dopamine. So it really begins to shut down that mechanism that is used to be able to enable it to produce dopamine. So it atrophies over time. That's why the symptoms oftentimes emerge in people at a slightly later age. There are many, many people who have the symptoms actually as teenagers and in their 20s, but more commonly the symptoms tend to emerge as people get into their 40s, 50s, and especially 60s. And again, that's because it just takes time for the body to finally give up that production mechanism. It can be, let me just stress, that whole mechanism of being able to produce dopamine can be reinstituted. It just takes the body a while to rebuild the systems that are needed to be able to accomplish that. So that's the second major category that can create the symptoms of Parkinson's. Now, there's a third category that I also want to put up on the list, and that category really falls into the area of injury. Some people have the symptoms because they have direct physical injuries to the cells that actually are responsible for manufacturing the over 40 hormonal systems in our bodies. And so this particular category of people fall into the area of those that have fallen out of trees when they were youngsters or as adults, people who were in automobile accidents, people who had abuse to the head of one type or another. I don't have any specific information about injuries to Muhammad Ali. Obviously, I don't know his health history, but the suspicion would be that the factors that have created his symptoms are more than likely due to this third category, that is, they are physical injuries at the cellular level. So the approaches that will be necessary to be able to help heal injuries at the cellular level will be very different from the approaches that would be suggested if trauma is at the top of the list or if toxins are at the top of the list. I mean, there's a very different protocol for addressing each of these. Now, I think it's also likely to be the case that everyone more than likely has some combination of these. So it's not as if one of these is the primary cause. It may be that, for example, there is some cellular damage, and that's a factor that creates the symptoms in combination with, let's say, trauma. It may be both of those. So I don't want to suggest that there's just one of these three factors that would be the primary reason why you have the symptoms. I mean, the life is complicated. The body is complicated. A lot of things happen to us over the course of our lives, and it may be that really the factors that create the symptoms are a function of the presence of all three of these. They can all have a profound impact on influencing the actual symptoms of Parkinson's disease. So I believe that one of the ways to approach figuring out what to do, and that's what this discussion is all about, is to step back and say, okay, let's just think about these three categories for myself. And let me see if I can sort through which of these three specific categories might be the category that is up for me now, the category that I really need to pay some attention to. This is where I need to focus my attention to now. Now, notice I didn't say exclusively. Notice I didn't say this is it for me. I said this is what's up for me now with regard to what my symptoms are actually telling me. So I think it's one way to begin to focus your search on what modalities or approaches are going to be most helpful and useful to you in getting relief from your symptoms. So that's the framework, and now the question is, how do you figure out which of these three would be most appropriate? And for that, there are a number of different suggestions that are possible. They all fall under the category of listening to your body, and they all assume that your body really knows the answers. You just have to figure out a way of communicating with your body so that you know what the answer is. So you have to open up a communication pathway between your mental thinking and the communication systems of your body so you can figure out, okay, what is my body telling me? What are these symptoms telling me that I need to pay attention to? Remember, if there is a symptom, it means your body is yelling out to you, hey, pay attention to me. There's something going on here. I need a little attention, and you need to do something for me. So please help out. And when you hear that, you've got to say, okay, good, great. Okay, fine. I'm going to pay attention. I'm going to listen to what it is that you actually have to say. Now, let me stop. I gave a number to several people. I don't know if they've been able to connect or call in or not. Let me just check and see. Is anybody out there? No, I guess not. I was thinking I might actually work with an individual or two, and I would show you how this actually worked, but it sounds like we don't have anyone who's actually called in. So what I'd like to do is, for those of you who are actually listening, what I'd like to do is to explain to you how I'd like to suggest that you proceed in trying to sort this through for yourself. And what we want to do is we want to ask our body. We don't want to ask our minds. So clearly, our minds have been doing a lot of thinking about, okay, what is this? What do I do? Blah, blah, blah. That's not where we're going to be able to get the answer. So there are several approaches that you can take to be able to get answers from your body, and I don't want to suggest that any one approach is better than another, any one that's necessarily going to work for you personally, but I want to just describe to you what the approaches might be and invite you to actually explore them now. Now, some of you out there may be having some difficulty with hand or finger dexterity, but for those of you who are not, let me explain to you this way of muscle testing your body. Essentially, it's a way that you can use for yourself to be able to ask your body questions. And what you'll want to do is to take your index finger, that's the largest finger of the four fingers on each of your hands, and touch your index finger with your thumb. Your index finger with your thumb. And so what you're doing is you're actually making a circle with the index finger and the thumb on one hand. And then do the very same thing with your other hand, the index finger and the thumb. But what you're going to do is you're going to put that ring inside the ring you've just formed so that you basically are forming something that looks like a chain, two links in a chain. So you're using both hands, and this is going to be a little difficult if you're listening on the phone because you may have to sort of put the phone down a bit or perhaps put your phone on a monitor so you can hear me continue to talk. So in other words, you've got your two circles that you formed with your index finger and your thumb. You've got them locked, so to speak. And now what you want to do is to be able to acknowledge that if you pull hard enough, you can separate these two rings. And so I want you to go ahead and form your chain. Put your big index finger and your thumb together with one hand, and then with the other hand, your big index finger and your thumb inside that ring so that you're forming two chains inside the other. And then what I want you to say out loud, don't worry, nobody here on the connection is going to hear you because I've got everybody muted, is say a name that is not your name. So if I were doing this, for example, I would say my name is Hank. And then what you want to do is see if you can pull those two rings apart. Just see if you can pull them apart. Now, if your body is properly hydrated, what's going to happen is you will immediately be able to pull those rings apart if your name is not Hank. If it's Hank, then you ought to not be able to pull those two rings apart. You ought to be able to find that those are going to be solidly connected. So that's a way of just testing to see, so you can feel like what this muscle testing actually feels like. When the body says yes, it's strong, so it does not allow those two rings to separate. So they're locked together. So when I say my name is Robert and I try to pull them apart, they're not going to pull apart easily. Now, of course, with my mind, I can pull them apart. But when I'm just yanking on it, my body is saying, that's right, your name is Robert, or my name is also Bob, or my name is Bobby. If I say any of those names, my body is going to say, yes, that's right, and I'm not going to be able to pull those two rings apart. So you can do a little testing, and you can get a feel for what it feels like when your body is saying, yes, that's right, which means that it's strong. And that's correct. That's the correct answer. And you can get a feeling for when it's saying, no, this is not it. This is not what you need to look at. So your body is giving you the answer. It's not a thinking thing. It's a body answer. Now, let me stress, this is really just there are many ways to muscle test the body. And I'm just giving you one example that I know for many of you who are listening is going to work quite beautifully. For others, it's just not going to work at all. So let's just start with this one way. And what I want to invite you to do now is we're going to go down through these three categories. And I'm going to invite you to test out each of these categories to see if that's what's up with your body right now. You're going to ask your body the question. So again, it's not an intellectual question, it's a body question. And what I want you to do before you start is just to say, you can say this to yourself with your thoughts, or you can say it out loud. What you want to say is, I now set the intention to receive what information my body has to tell me, whatever that might be. You just set the intention to get the information that your body is conveying to you. And, of course, you don't want your mind to override what your body has to say. Now, you've already thought about these three categories, and you may already have an idea of which one it is in your head. That's not the answer that we want to get from this. The answer that we want to get is the answer that your body is going to give to you. So having now set the intention, and again, go ahead and do that now. You want to say, I declare that I want to know what my body has to tell me about which of these three categories is the one I need to pay attention to now. I want to know the truth. You set that intention and then put your chain together, so to speak, of your two hands, so one of the circles inside the other. And then what I invite you to say, and you can say this in your thoughts or you can say it out loud, what you want to say is, toxins are what I need to pay attention to today. Toxins are what I need to pay attention to today. And then pull apart the two rings you formed and see if they stay or see if they very quickly fall apart. Toxins are what I need to pay attention to today. And again, pull apart and just see how your body feels. It may be some question. It may be it is or it isn't. That may be that's the answer. It may be it's a very strong yes. And remember, the yes means it's hard for you to pull those two rings apart. And it may be, boy, you could pull them apart with no problem. That means your body is saying, no. Toxins is not what's up for today. Now, I want to stress, remember, the question is, this is what I need to pay attention to today. We're not asking, are toxins what happens to be up for you? That's not the question. The question is, what choices do I need to begin focusing in on today? So having gotten that answer, we're going to obviously move to the other two. So we'll move to trauma as the second choice to be considered. And we're going to ask the very same question and do the very same testing. So what you want to do is form a ring with your left hand and a ring with your right hand with your index finger and your thumb, and put those two rings together as if they're in a chain. And what you want to say in your mind or with your thoughts out loud will be, trauma is what I need to pay attention to today. And then muscle test. See if you can pull apart the two rings. Trauma is what I need to pay attention to today. And see if you can pull it apart. You can test it several times to get a feel here for whether or not that's up for you or not. And there may the message may be a bit confusing. It may be that, oh, you can kind of pull them apart or you can, it's not really clear. Again, that may be the answer your body is giving you, that, yeah, trauma is up, but, you know, it's not up. So, that may be actually the answer that your body is giving you. It's not necessarily going to be a clear yes or a no. And then we want to move to the third question, which is injury. And that's really, we're talking here about cellular injury. So what you want to do is to put your two rings together. And what you want to say to yourself out loud is, cellular injury is what is up for me today and what I need to pay attention to. And again, see if you can separate those two rings out or not. So see if you can pull them apart. If they pull apart very easily, it means, nope, that's not what's up for you. But if it's really difficult to separate those two rings from that chain, then that means that, yep, that looks like that's going to be it. So what you can do, those are the three general categories, is you may now, for the many people who are listening to this, you may have a pretty clear answer as to what your body is telling you about those three general categories. It may be it's not clear, and you've got to do that again and again. You don't want to consider just doing this one time. You can continue to ask. Now, if you know the answer already from what your body is telling you, what you'll want to do now is to just check in with your instinct and intuition and ask yourself, okay, does this feel right to me? Just feel it. Does this answer feel right to me? It's a feeling. It's an instinct. It's an intuition. It's a flash. Is this right or wrong? Now, if you're getting a sense, I don't know about it, well, that's a signal that you need to do some more checking in with your body, because your own instincts here are going to be a key to the avenue that you need to pursue to be able to get some relief from your symptoms. So always trust that instinct. For me, it's a visceral thing. I actually get a shiver down my spine that tells me, yep, that's it, that's the one. It can be just a feeling of assurance where, yes, this has got to be right. You may have thoughts that immediately flood in, regardless of what these three categories is, memories and thoughts. Well, those are clues about what is up and what needs to be paid attention to now. Again, this is not the only thing, but it's up. It's what is up for you now and what needs to be paid attention to now, today. So I want to suggest don't just do the muscle test. You can also check in with your own instinct, with your own intuition, and see if it feels right. And that's another huge piece of information for you. Now, I want to offer another way of muscle testing for those of you that may not have gotten an answer, a clear answer from that first round of muscle testing. And many people say, well, but can I trick my body? Can I trick my body into telling me what I want my body to tell me? Well, if you set the intention, hello?
Hello, Robert.
Yes, who is this?
Hans Derek from Holland.
Hans, hello, how are you? So we have Hans who's just joined us, and I guess you might have been listening, Hans, but I was just going through some testing for people of those three areas.
Yeah, I heard you, so just go on.
Did you have a chance to do any of that for yourself?
No, I was just trying to contact you, so I didn't have the opportunity to do the exercises.
Oh, shoot. Well, would you like to try it now to see if you can figure out which of these three might be up for you?
I think that's not the right moment with the telephone in my hand and shaking with my body because I'm nervous, so.
Oh, okay. That this is it, and that particular test is not necessarily a test that would be a good one to pursue for everyone. Have you ever done muscle testing before?
Yes, I've done it before.
Has it worked for you?
Yeah, I got a little information, but it was long ago that I did it.
And the information was helpful?
As far as I can remember, it was helpful.
Oh, good.
It was about 10, 15 years ago I did it.
I see. Well, I'm really arguing here that there are several approaches for muscle testing, and one approach, you can go to a healthcare practitioner who is a specialist in helping you be able to muscle test. There are people that we have gone to for muscle testing, and what they will do is they will put you on a table, and you'll put your arm up straight. And then the practitioner will literally touch the various organs of your body, and they very gently push on your arm. I mean, they almost are not even touching you physically. It's almost an energetic test. And they can tell whether or not your body is saying yes or no just by that very gentle and energetic assessment. So there are healthcare practitioners who are very skilled at being able to help us communicate with our bodies, but what I'm doing here is suggesting to people that as a first step, we can always muscle test ourselves. We don't have to go to a professional to get them to do it for us. We can do it ourselves, or we can get a friend to be able to help us out. Have you ever done muscle testing, Hans, where you put your arm out straight and then somebody else pushes your arm down?
Yes. It was amazing.
And you were able to confirm that your body was able to give you information in that way.
Yes, things I couldn't know. The woman could define everything she wanted to know from my body. So.
Oh, that's so cool. I have to say this, Hans. Now, we didn't cook this up before this conversation, right? We didn't talk about, hey, you know, tell everybody that this really works. So we didn't have any, obviously, conversation before this. And it really is quite amazing. So you were able to get information in that way that you otherwise wouldn't have been able to get.
Yes.
Oh, that's so cool. Well, let me ask you then, without going through the formal muscle testing for the body, of these three general areas, toxins and trauma and injury, cellular injury, does one of those categories feel like it's at the top for you today?
I don't know if it's for today, but I think trauma is a very important cause for me, especially when I was in the program of the Parkinson Recovery Project. Then the trauma was the main cause of the Parkinson's, and the woman who invented everything in the Parkinson Project, Janice Walton Hadlock, she talked about injuries in our youth with our feet. Maybe you know the theory.
Yes, yes.
Are you familiar with the theory about...
Yes, yes, I'm very familiar. I'm not sure other people are, so you might want to explain to other people what her theory is.
It's quite simple. It's better to read it on the website. The book she published is free to read on the website on the Parkinson's Recovery Project. But in general, it's like you have a wound in your foot, and that has to do something with the stomach channel. It's a Chinese theory of acupuncture, and the wound in your foot, your feet, has to do something with causing Parkinson's and causing the damage in your brain and stopping the dopamine to flow. And the therapy is Yin Phi Na. That's a soft Chinese therapy. That means we in Amsterdam had a Yin Phi Na center where one of the therapists from America, from her center in California, came over to Holland every 3 months to give the treatment. So one treatment was to get the Yin Phi Na sessions, and the other treatment was, let's say, your full transformation from someone who is afraid to someone who is living in joy. And this is a very simple explanation, so it's better to read the book from Janice Walton Hadlock on the internet.
Were you able to get some sense of the trauma that you had experienced in your life that was the causal factor?
No, I didn't know nothing of a wound in my youth, but there were certain different persons, and their stories are also in her book on the internet, that told about dramas and traumas in the youth with their feet.
Ah.
So, but I couldn't remember one. But I was a member of the project for about 3 years, and in the first half year I had very much results in a way that my smell came back and my knees softened and some of the pains diminished in my feet and my legs. So I was very happy to do the therapy. But after 4 years of doing the therapy every week, going to Amsterdam, the things changed and I couldn't move in my bed. I couldn't roll around, and so things getting better. So my wife said, you got 4 years practicing Eastern therapy, but now it's over. You go to the neurologist and find some medicine. So, and that's the point from the program. They don't want you. They don't want you in the program as you take medicine. So the program stopped.
Yes. Is the smell still stayed, or did that also go away after 4 years?
No, this is still here. I can't. It's difficult to say by day, but. It's still there.
Ah.
For me, was it an important signal that in the beginning the program really worked.
Are you able to then find ways to address the trauma now?
Yeah, I think when I look back at my life, I was very afraid of life, and I didn't realize it. So the last 5 years since my diagnosis 5.5 years ago, I'm going through a kind of transformation process. In the beginning, it started with periods of very deep depression for 6 or 4 months, which I overcome. And after that, I did a lot of crying. I think I cried for 1,000 times a year, let's say. But it gave me very much insight of what happened in my life, and especially how I interacted with fear and how that influenced my life. So I think I'm still afraid, but I'm very much aware of it. And people call me more transparent. They can see, you know the term transparent?
Yes.
Yes. Hello, gentlemen.
So that's a change for the better. People look at me and they say, you're really going through a transformation process that makes you more beautiful and transparent.
Oh, that's a wonderful story. I have a question that I've been sitting on for several days. I get questions every day. This one I've been sitting on because I haven't really decided how to respond to it. It's a person who wrote one sentence, and they said, I am desperately depressed from Parkinson's. What can I do about it? What would be your answer to that question?
Maybe there are different answers. I had known the EFT therapy, Emotional Freedom Techniques.
Yes.
You know that?
Yes, yes. We blogged about that a bit.
Tapping the points on your head and your shoulders and under your arms. And it really helped me in depressive states to tap the points and say the sentences you have to say. And it wasn't helpful in my deepest depressions, but it really helped me with the small daily depressions to come out within 10 or 15 minutes. It's really miraculous, if I say the word good.
You're beautifully.
So EFT, it really helped me.
Oh, that's a wonderful suggestion. And having blogged on this before, there's information on it on Parkinson's Recovery. You can also type in Emotional Freedom Technique on the Internet using Google. And you'll be able to get lots of information on the Internet about EFT, free suggestions, information, et cetera, et cetera. So that's a wonderful suggestion.
The second suggestion I have is I did 2 long periods of psychotherapy, and it was really helpful for me. And the main thing I discovered is that I was a victim of my own life, and I needed to take the lead again to become the boss of my own life and not fall back into self-pity, which is very clear that you can have that. But you just take the opposite, and being the conductor of your life was very important to discover during those therapy sessions.
Oh, how fascinating. Well, of course, that's a big theme of Parkinson's Recovery, is to give people all of the information and resources that they need to be able to take control of their life.
Yeah. And one thing that, as far as your question from tonight concerns, the choices you make, I have one sentence that's very important for me. And I put my hand on my heart to make a small or big decision, and that's the sentence, what is good for me here and now? You understand?
In other words, tell me once more, you're placing your hand on your heart.
I have a question about a new therapy or a new decision I have to make. Put my hand on my heart, and I'm asking myself, what is good for me here and now?
Uh-huh.
And then I can look inside and see feel my intuition, and then a decision is made.
And then
and
what?
I also use it, for instance, when I'm in a situation with other people, and I feel that it's becoming too much for me, that the bottle is full, then I'm feeling sometimes secretly and sometimes openly putting my hand on my heart, and I'm feeling, yes, what is good for me here and now is just leave this situation. So that's what I'm telling the people I'm with, and then I leave.
Oh, enough. Right.
You understand?
So you're using that really also as a moment-to-moment decision.
Yes.
What do I need to do for myself now?
Robert, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yes, yes.
Lovino here, can you hear me?
Oh, hello, yes. So we have another person who just...
I've been on 10 minutes listening. I said hello a few times, but I didn't know if you'd be picked up or not. So I was just going to email you, and I thought I'd say hello one more time before...
Oh, hello. Yes, so for everybody who's listening, we've been talking with Hans from Holland, and Lovino has just connected in and is also saying hello. And I don't know whether
Should
you were hearing.
My story, Robert?
Yes, because yes. Hans was just telling us ways that he has of being able to make his choices. So
mm-hmm.
let's see if he can finish.
On depression, I could give you a couple of others. Light therapy works very well, very proven. Clinical trials have proven its effectiveness, and it's non-invasive. Using a daylight lamp for 30 minutes a day. The other one that works really well that's been proven that is the resonance therapy, magnetic therapy works as well.
Oh, great.
And both of them are non-invasive therapies.
Good. Two wonderful suggestions, especially an answer to that person who was so desperately depressed and who probably is not in the position to do EFT right now but needs something else. So
yeah, light therapy is very inexpensive. I mean, you buy the light for probably €100 or $150, and it's a one-time purchase. You plug it in, and then you just...
And it works, and boy, does it make a difference. Right.
Exactly.
Right. So, Hans, do you want to finish your explanation here?
Sorry, Hans, I just wanted to say hello. Carry on.
Oh, thank you, Lovino,
yeah.
And we'll get back to you here in just a minute.
Of course.
In the answer to your question about making choices, there are big decisions. I have one means to make a big decision. One day, let's say the example of starting with medicines, which I had to take last year. One day I'm talking about all day about not taking medicines. I talk about it with other people, talk about it with my wife at our meals. The second day I talk about the opposite, taking medicine. The third day I'm back again talking about not taking medicine. And when I'm hearing myself the third and the fourth day talking, I can really hear what's really important and which arguments are nonsense. So the fourth day on that occasion, I felt that I could make a decision.
Oh, what a wonderful strategy. That's so eloquent. So you spend, let me get this right, you spend the whole day talking about the medicines for that day, and then the next day you reverse it and talk about not taking them and listen to yourself talk. And then reverse it again, and then you really are able to sort through as you're listening to yourself talk what's the right decision for you.
Yeah, it's a beautiful method.
Oh, that is a beautiful method, I must say. I'm going to use that. That's absolutely eloquent.
And the third one, which I remembered, is to sharpen my intuition, that I feel sometimes that I have to do something despite the rational arguments. It was, for instance, last year I read in the papers that Leonard Cohen was coming to Amsterdam. And this is a man who was in all my life, accompanied me from my 19th birthday till now with his music.
That's why you're depressed.
And I feel I had to go, despite bad expectations, because he had a bad voice on his latest CD. I hate being with 10,000 people. I couldn't sleep in the afternoon. I walked dead. But there was something in the air that I really felt I had to go, in spite of all the rational expectations. So I made a visualization. Is that the right word for it? Visualization?
Yes.
Visualization? I visualized
it. Yes, that's a proper word.
Right, yes.
Okay. And I saw myself in a wheelchair, pushed by a friend. And I find out where to park the car, and I bought a special invalid ticket. And so I did everything. I saw it before, and it became a wonderful experience. Pieces of the puzzle fell on their place. And I sat there sometimes listening with tears in my eyes to the best concert I had heard in the last 20 years.
Oh.
So that's using my intuition.
And then trusting the intuition was telling you the right thing to do.
Yeah, that's true. And my last point is maybe a very practical point, if you don't mind. I invented something with my physiotherapist, a new way to walk for me, to walk better. Maybe everybody knows it, but I never heard about it. She asked me last week to bounce with a great big plastic ball and then to walk. So I could walk with the ball, and then she said, take a smaller ball, like a tennis ball. And now I'm walking, like old days, bouncing the ball all day on the street, in the school where I work, at home. I don't know if this trick is well known. I never heard of it before, but it's really amazing that the people look at me and say, wow, what's happened?
You mean you're able to walk effortlessly as you bounce?
Yeah. So I'd like to invite everybody who's listening to experiment and to let you know the results, because I'm very amazed that it works like this.
Oh, that is amazing to me. Lavino, had you heard of anything like that before?
No, I want a clearer explanation. So you walk and bounce like you're dribbling a ball?
Yeah, like a basketball, but then with a small ball, but you can do it with a basketball. And I'm really 60, 70% better walking.
Really?
And you can do it also on another way. A friend of mine was also a person with Parkinson's. He did it with a football, a big football from plastic. And he was playing football, and like I was in the afternoon in the shop this afternoon, and I took a shop basket. That's the word for it, where you put your things in.
Yes.
Yes.
Shopping
in
basket.
Uh-huh.
And I put it. I did it like a football. I treated it like a football, and so I could walk through the whole the whole store with my things in it.
Wow. I've never heard of that before.
Okay, now, I hope everybody's trying to
great.
Take the experiment and let you know, Robert, the results, because I was amazed about it.
You're going to have a lot of people who are going to be trying that out, Hans.
That's a
marvelous idea. I want to ask just a clarification on the football. So you're not bouncing that on the ground. Are you tossing it up in the air?
No, not tossing it in the air, just kicking, small kick.
Kicking it from side to side?
Yeah, so you have to put it in your neighborhood, so you have to be careful. But it really works for me less than bouncing the tennis ball, but it also works.
I see. Oh, those are amazing suggestions.
Great fun, and it's better to walk in the street with a ball bouncing than with a stick. With a stick, people think you're old, and with the ball, they
think you're a child.
Yeah. I think it's dopamine producing better than walking with a stick and
let
people look at you.
Yes, and you're picking up the energy of, oh, heavens, look at that old person with that stick.
Yeah,
instead, when they see you with the ball, it's, oh, look at that young person having a good time. It's a very different feeling.
So.
Interesting.
Do you have any other suggestions for us, Hans?
I have a lot of suggestions, but I think the time is up now, like I told you before.
Yes.
What's good for me here and now. And for me here and now, it's good to stop. And maybe some other time, Robert, we'd like to meet.
That would be wonderful, Hans. I thank you from the bottom of my heart for joining us today. This was a long-distance call over many, many miles. And so thank you for doing that. I know everybody will greatly appreciate your wisdom and your experience.
Okay, go on like this, Robert, and... maybe one day we'll meet.
That would be wonderful. Let's set that intention and make it so.
And,
thank you, Hans.
Be happy here and now.
Thank you, Hans.
Okay. See you, Robert.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye, Hans.
So, Lavino, anything else you'd like to add to this discussion?
Well, I'm not sure where it started because I got in late into the conversation when he was talking about the foot therapy and how it worked for about 4 years, and then it stopped working?
Yes, that's what he said.
Yeah, and I don't know what he said before that, so that's where I came in.
Yes, no, that was basically it. That's where he started with his journey and basically said the trauma was at the top of his list of what's been the focus of his work over the years, which very clearly has resulted in a significant relief in his symptoms.
Mm-hmm. And if you look at Parkinson's.org, there's a couple of postings or on the forum group where someone else, there's a woman that speaks about her husband going through the same therapy for 5 years, and he got some relief. But by no means did it go away. And then they were told that it was because he'd been on levodopa, and so then they started saying that they wouldn't guarantee anybody who's taken any meds to be treated and relieved of symptoms. And the other thing that's missing from that evidence that I find a little bothersome is they don't have a support group that's part of their patient list that would say, you know, call me and I'll be more than glad to verify the results, or no testimonials from anybody that you can access.
Right, right.
And I find that bothersome because if someone helped me relieve my symptoms or cure me, if you want to use that word, I find it a bit of a challenge to use that word, but then I'd be more than glad to be a testimonial for anybody. Why wouldn't you?
Exactly. Well, of course, I'm very familiar with Janice Walton Haddock's work and her writing. She's very much a clinician and has a very specific focus with the work that she does. She's not a researcher, and so I don't think her energy or focus is directed toward collecting evidence from people who have been able to get relief or not relief from whatever therapies they've had. And actually, the truth is that she was one of the inspirations for me of launching the Parkinson's recovery work, mm-hmm. because I felt as though it was necessary to begin to systematically document what was really happening. I also personally drew the conclusion that her theory was quite fascinating and concluded that it really was applicable to some people, that really was the underlying factor that created the conditions. But I've really stepped back, and I have a much larger and broader view of the causes that contribute to Parkinson's. So you'll be able to map what I say against what she says and see there are pretty significant differences. She has a very specific focus, and mine is much more general. And my interest is in being able to, as you suggest, document. So we're advocating the first 100 study, and have a proposal that we've actually submitted to the Google people, who have a contest. And this particular proposal is that Google funds a study of 100 individuals who have been diagnosed with the symptoms of Parkinson's for 3 years. And these 100 individuals receive comprehensive sets of therapies that address all the various underlying causes that I just identified. And so they get the support that they need to be able to get some significant relief from their symptoms. But we track all of their progress over that 3-year period of time.
Mm.
And we as we go through, we actually do experiments with trying one thing or another and see what really happens with people. So it's an ongoing action-oriented experiment. As a researcher, it's very different from the typical kind of research that you see out there in the academic community. With the typical research, they control everything and isolate only one intervention. They look at the effect of only one factor on, in this case, the symptoms of Parkinson's. And that really is the way traditional science has been done. That's the way I've done it over the years. It's the way you
What's
get published,
background?
By the way, in referee journals. But I don't think that's the way to be able to figure out what it is that can genuinely help people with the symptoms of Parkinson's. I think what you have to do is this comprehensive intervention and systematically track month by month exactly what goes on and report that so that we know what the effects of these various interventions are. So I don't know whether the proposal is going to get on the list of 100 to be voted on. I guess they're going to do that within the next few days. I'm optimistic. I hope that it would be one of the 100 ideas. It's not a study that I would do myself. It's an idea that I'm proposing that needs to be done.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll let everybody know what the result was. I wish everybody listening would set their intention to put out some good energy to the people at Google so that we'll be able to get on the list and get people to notice the importance of doing a study just like this.
What's your have you been diagnosed with PD, or are you doing this as a research?
No, I have not. I do not have Parkinson's. My mother had Parkinson's. She basically died from an overdose of taking many, many, many medications. She had a stroke. And so that's part of my a big part of my enthusiasm for doing the work is that I really felt like that didn't need to happen. And the medications were not just Parkinson's medications. Don't get me wrong. She was she had medications for many different kind of conditions, but that's really what created her death. And now my uncle is in the end stages of Parkinson's, and so that's a very sad thing. He was a college president and a man of many, many talents and abilities, and he's now really in the dying stages. And so I have two people in my family that I dearly loved who've had Parkinson's, and so decided that this was something I needed to do.
Well, thank you for doing it, taking the time. It's a big job.
Well, it is, but it's meant a great deal to me, and it does feel like to me that what I see for the most part out there as a belief system is a negative belief system. But when I talk to people, what I learn is that there are many pioneers out there, just as Hans was describing, who are creating and inventing ways to get just significant relief from symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
And leading very productive and exciting lives. So a big part of what I'm doing here is being able to document those stories so that everybody can realize that there are many, many options for them to be able to feel better and get huge relief from their symptoms.
Excellent. Excellent. Now, have you have you been in touch with, like, the Michael J. Fox Foundation to stay abreast of what they're doing, getting research results are, and things like that? Or?
I am, of course, very familiar with their wonderful work. The Michael J. Fox group is very much into the medical framework, and we
yes.
need foundations and groups that do that. They fund university research that's focused research. The approach I'm really advocating is, I want to say it's a radical approach. I mean, I'm a very quantitative scientist. If you look at the work I've done, I'm very statistical, very quantitative, and I'm well aware that what I am proposing to the scientific community would not be acceptable to any review committee anywhere. My work's been reviewed time and time and time again by review committees, so I know what's expected. And the study that I'm proposing would not pass through the reviewers that are affiliated with the Michael J. Fox Foundation, because their framework is of that scientific review framework.
Right.
So I decided, you know what, that's an approach that's valuable. I did it for 20 years myself, and I'm proud of the work that I did, but I don't think that's the approach that's going to give us significant insights over what people can do to really get huge relief from their symptoms. I think the approach I'm advocating is the way I want to suggest that we go. And again, it's what we would call an action research model. There is evidence that some science is moving in this direction. I personally believe that if we rely exclusively on the traditional scientific method, which is very, very, very slow, that no one with the symptoms of Parkinson's today will benefit from the results of that approach. It's just too slow. It's too
right.
narrow. It seems to me we need a much broader perspective. And so that's what I'm advocating that we take. And so the approach I took, instead of approaching specific foundations as Michael J. Fox, which is a wonderful foundation, I decided, well, I'll go to places like Google.
Different approach altogether.
It's a different approach. And, you know, here it is. This is an idea. And I thought, okay. And then if we can get them to list this idea on their list of 100, then we can get my very large audience to begin to vote on that and express their preference for this is something that ought to be done. And maybe we can actually get the project done. It's going to cost several million to fund all the therapies, all the treatments that will be necessary to do, and of course the researchers that have to track the results. So it's a very costly idea.
And the treatments would be scientific and non-scientific, or would they just be alternative medicine, and what would the treatments be?
Well, it would be, it would be trial and error, but we would be talking about, if we're talking about toxins, there are obviously a large number of approaches for being able to help the body rid itself of toxins, and so we would be entering that, depending on what the particular person's situation was, with certain approaches or therapies that would help them detox their bodies.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be very individualistic, working very slowly and tenderly so that the person was not receiving too much too quickly. And if something didn't work, then we would lift that off and try another approach. So it would be done by teams of professionals, of naturopaths, medical doctors, healthcare professionals, energy workers, acupuncturists, a whole group of people.
So the whole gamut from A to Z?
The whole gamut. And many people get the idea that I'm sort of anti-medicine or anti-medical community. That there's anything but that to be the truth. It's that if we consider everything as possible help, then we'll be able to move the field much farther, much quicker. And
it's
so there's no judgment about anything, really. It's just to do an ongoing experiment and see where we can go with that.
Excellent.
Well, that's the
idea.
I think
a multidisciplinary approach is always best.
It is. And actually, there are studies of Parkinson's that show that's the case, too. When you ever have multidisciplinary teams and multidisciplinary work with people, there's significant improvement. So the idea is not to have a single-minded focus for what needs to happen. And, of course, that's where Janice Walton Haddock, as we were discussing earlier, and I differ.
Yes.
She has a very specific focus, which I think has value. And I've told her personally how much I admire the work she's doing. But I think that's a narrow focus that's appropriate to some people, but not all. And so the key is that the factors that contribute to the symptoms are pretty widespread. And so it seems to me that what's going to really help people is also has a high range of possibilities. So that's the idea that we've got for what we're doing.
Excellent.
So I want to thank Lavino, you, for joining us here
thank
in this conversation.
Thank
and
you for the opportunity possible.
Oh, of course. And Hans for calling in from Holland and with his incredibly helpful insights and suggestions for everyone, and invite everybody to join us. I'll be here a week from now, and I'll be talking about the first of four steps that are needed for being able to commit yourself to a road to recovery. We also have a discussion on meditation, on teleseminar and meditation that's coming up. On the teleseminar page, there's a link at the bottom to the Parkinson's Recovery website. I want to invite everybody to click on that link and type in for the username the word recover, RECOVER, and the password READY, READY. There are interviews and resources and meditations and jokes and recipes and exercises and you name it, everything that you need to be able to get relief from symptoms, especially if you pay attention to them day in and day out. So check out what's there. Those resources are available for you to be able to take, download, look at, read, and listen to. And that is what is happening at Parkinson's Recovery on the shores of the Puget Sound, where all the men are handsome, all the women are smart, and all the children are loved. Know that you are on the road to recovery. Good day.
Thank you, Rob.
The moderator has disconnected. The call will now end.